Hi there, you're listening to StyClex Explains. This is our channel dedicated to bringing you junior cycle and leaving cert notes in podcast form. For this podcast, we've teamed up once again with Peter Tobin, an expert teacher who's going to take you through everything you need to know about the poet Patrick Kavanagh and their poems that are on the Leaving Cert English syllabus. So without further ado, the next voice you're going to hear is Peter's. We hope you find this useful.
Hi everyone and welcome to this StudyClex podcast on the poet Patrick Kavanagh. My name is Peter, I'm an English teacher. I've also got a channel on YouTube called Mr. Tobin Leaving Cert English, so be sure to check that out for more free resources and videos on other aspects of the Leaving Cert course. In this podcast, we're going to take a look at Kavanagh's background, what makes his poetry stand out as his, and examine the poems that have been chosen for the Leaving Cert syllabus. First, let's have a look at the poet himself. Patrick Kavanagh was born in Inniskeen, County Monaghan in 1904. The son of a farmer and cobbler, Kavanagh left school at the age of 13 to become an apprentice cobbler as well as help his father work the land. As shoemaking became less and less relevant with the opening of shoe shops and factories, the Kavanagh family focused exclusively on farming, expanding their land to 25 acres. Much of that work fell to Patrick and his brother, but when Patrick was 25, his father died and his younger brother went to Dublin to train to be a teacher. This meant Patrick remained on the farm with his mother, running the family business. Despite his leaving school at a young age, Kavanagh, in the few spare minutes he got from running the farm, read and wrote poetry. In 1928, the year before his father died, he had his first poem published in the Irish Independent Weekly, but it was his connection with George Russell, who published some of Kavanagh's work in the Irish Statesman, that really catapulted Kavanagh from his rural home in Monaghan into the literary circles in Dublin and later London. In 1931, Kavanagh walked the 60 miles or so from his home in Inniskeen to Dublin to meet George Russell. And when he left with an armful of books as well as support and encouragement to continue on his poetic enterprise. It is this 6 or 7 year time period where Kavanagh is described as a farmer by day and a poet by night. He continued to work the family farm while spending the evenings writing his poetry and eventually, in 1936, had his first collection of poetry published by a London publisher. This first collection of poetry saw Kavanagh often patronised as a country or peasant poet. While he was keen to show the realities of rural life, in contrast to lots of other poetry common at that time, that idealised country life or romanticised it, he also recognised that the peasant quality of both him and his work was what attracted people to his work in the first place. It is in this first collection that we begin to see the theme of the difference between the half-talk code of farming people in Inniskeen and the solemn talk of serious poetry and poetry people emerge. In her introduction to his collected works, Antoinette Quinn says that in 1936, Kavanagh was still a full-time farmer, hopeful that some rich Dublin person would pluck him from the fields. When this failed to happen, he decided to try his luck in London. So in 1937, in London, Kavanagh was commissioned to write his autobiography, which he completed in a matter of months. It was called The Green Fool, and although Kavanagh later came to hate it, because he thought it amplified the stereotypes and peasant quality of rural life, it was very well received, and it announced Kavanagh on the literary stage, both in London and in Dublin. Disaster soon struck, however. Someone mentioned in the book, in the autobiography, The Green Fool, a man called Oliver St. John Gogarty, an Irish poet and former Free State Senator, sued the publisher of the book for libel because of a throwaway remark made by Kavanagh about him. In the book, when referring to a visit to Gogarty's home, Kavanagh wrote, "I mistook Gogarty's white-robed maid for his wife or mistress. I expected every poet to have a spare wife." Gogarty, who had taken offence at the close coupling of the words wife and mistress, was awarded £100 in damages, and the book wasn't republished for another 30 years in 1967. That was the year that Kavanagh died. So penniless, and with another collection of poetry being rejected by various publishers, as well as the publisher of The Green Fool, arguing that Kavanagh owed him money on account of the successful libel, Kavanagh couldn't afford to stay on in London, and instead he returned to Ireland. But rather than returning to Monaghan, Kavanagh stayed with his brother in Dublin and attempted to get work as a journalist as well as working on his poetry. He was determined to abandon farming altogether and focus solely on writing. But his arrival in Dublin coincided with the outbreak of World War II, and so Ireland's position of neutrality made Ireland and its literary scene outsiders to the literary community at large, and there was no appetite for Irish writing at this time amongst audiences in the UK or America. Kavanagh struggled in the years that followed to hold down jobs, as well as to find publishers for his poetry. Although he was a prolific writer, turning out hundreds of poems, Antoinette Quinn writes that Kavanagh, at this stage, still had no sense of direction, was unable to distinguish between the good and bad among his own verses, and asked advice of almost everyone he knew. She goes on to add that Kavanagh was a hit-and-miss writer, occasionally turning out a fine lyric. This time spent in Dublin was also spent socialising with many poets of the time, as well as a variety of writers and intellectuals. Much of this interaction only served to make him more aware of his own lack of education, having left school so early, and it is in these years that he begins to develop issues around alcohol. In these years, he felt that he was an outsider in the city and lived a hand-to-mouth existence, working variously as a film critic, a columnist, an editor, and a contributor to various literary publications. In 1942, disillusioned with the relationship between the Irish state and the Catholic Church, Kavanagh wrote the poem The Great Hunger, which was controversial, not just because it involved criticism of the church, but also because it included detailed descriptions of the reality of the bachelor farmer's life in Ireland, not a romanticised version of country life. While it was controversial and received with hostility in certain quarters, it was celebrated by many of Kavanagh's fellow writers and recognised as a remarkable literary achievement. With the publication of The Great Hunger and the death 3 years earlier of W.B. Yeats, Patrick Kavanagh was announcing himself as one of the preeminent poets in Ireland at this time. This level of success was not to be sustained, however, and despite this and other successes, including some well-received poems and another autobiographical novel, Tarry Flynn, in 1948, Kavanagh struggled to establish himself with regular collections of work. Throughout the 1940s and 50s, Kavanagh had occasional gems, but struggled to both keep jobs and stay sober. He became known around Dublin as a bit of a character, and he was liable to insult any adults who assumed familiarity with him. Towards children, he was reputed to be kind and affable, telling them stories and giving them sweets. This sense of Kavanagh as outsider or misfit amongst Dublin's writerly class was emphasised by the way he dressed and carried himself. Antoinette Quinn says, "To those he befriended, he was an entertaining and endearing man. To those he deliberately alienated, he was a monster." Through these years, drinking and writing columns, Kavanagh made many enemies around Dublin and was constantly attacking what he saw as the complacent and self-congratulatory sense of Ireland's own cultural importance. He despised the talk in the pubs of literature and saw it as a replacement of the actual work of writing. He lashed out at the church, the state, Fianna Fáil and the Irish middle classes and the previous poetic establishment as well, headed by Yeats. Kavanagh himself was attacked in a column in 1952 in a Dublin magazine. He sued, was unsuccessful, appealed, and was eventually successful, but he was humiliated during the trial, and it took a lot out of him. In 1955, Kavanagh was diagnosed with lung cancer. He underwent surgery, made a recovery, and had a sort of spiritual renewal. There are a number of poems from this period on the course, including his Canal poems and A Christmas Childhood. A number of poems from this period were also published in his 1960 collection, Come Dance with Kitty Stoblin. After this collection, and for the remaining years of Kavanagh's life, he still hoped he would rein in his drinking and his gambling, but unfortunately he never did. The more he drank, thanks to regular work for the Farmer's Journal and the RTE Guide, the more his poetic output shrank. And in these years too, as he was recognised for the skill and innovation of many of his earlier works, he was constantly compared to W.B. Yeats, with whom he had a very complex relationship. The Ireland of W.B. Yeats was the Protestant, middle-upper-class Ireland that viewed the peasant as magical and mythical, reducing the farming classes to simple stereotypes in an idealised, romanticised version of rural life. Kavanagh, who was representative of that Catholic Irish peasant, railed against this characterisation, and although at the beginning it was precisely this characterisation that got him admitted to literary circles, he rejected it throughout much of his poetry, primarily in The Great Hunger, and he was determined to show how the Irish farming class were treated by the government of the day and the Catholic Church, likening their lives to that of prisoners. For example, in The Great Hunger, Patrick McGuire is imprisoned by the land, the church, and essentially by his mother. At the very end of his life, Kavanagh began to enjoy the recognition that he had tried to get throughout his life. His collected poems had been published, as well as reissues of Tarry Flynn and a stage adaptation of the same book. He was even awarded a British Arts Council Award in 1967 in recognition of his work, and was almost as well known in Britain as in Dublin. In Ireland, however, he received no state acknowledgement, no financial assistance, no state pension. The lack of recognition from the state a state that he had attacked in print mercilessly for years for what he saw as neglect and hypocrisy, as well as collusion with the Catholic Church, was somewhat balanced out by the reputation he had amongst his fellow writers and amongst the new generation of poets and students who saw Kavanagh as Ireland's leading poet. Kavanagh died in Dublin in 1967 and was buried in Inniskeen, perhaps vindicating someone who had struggled with insecurity and self-confidence his whole life. That same year, 1967, a few months before his death, his work was added to the Leaving Cert curriculum, and it has been there ever since. Okay, so let's take a look at some of the themes that we see in Kavanagh's poetry. Kavanagh explores many ideas in his work, but there are some themes that emerge again and again and are especially useful to be aware of when studying Kavanagh for the Leaving Cert. Seamus Heaney, who is a devotee of Kavanagh's and who cited Kavanagh as a major influence on his own work, said of him, "He cherished the ordinary, the actual, the known, the unimportant." First and foremost, Kavanagh is a poet of place. Whether it's Shankaduff, Inniskeen, or the Grand Canal in Dublin, Kavanagh identifies the most innocuous of details, shines his light on the ordinary to make the everyday epic, to make the specific universal. The only difference, according to Heaney, between things, men, places, events, being important or not, is the light of the mind that is playing on them. In other words, things are made important by the quality of the poet that writes about them. In Kavanagh's case, he focuses on small details in order to bring to life the universal importance of everyday things, whether it's a simple dispute about land in Epic, or a green stone lying sideways in a ditch in A Christmas Childhood, whatever he shines his light on or brings his focus to is transformed. This leads us to another important theme in Kavanagh's work, which is the role of the poet and the life of the poet. We see, both in Kavanagh's life and in his poems, such as Inniskeen Road, a detachment from society. It's almost as if, to have that keen eye for detail, to be able to depict what he sees around him, he needs to be detached from that society. This obviously has profound effects on the poet. Kavanagh spent his years in Dublin feeling like an outsider, but it was exactly this outsider status that allowed him to write some of his finest poems, such as The Great Hunger. There's an interesting irony in these ideas, as Heaney, writing about Kavanagh, said, "For 30 years, he lived the life of a small farmer's son in the parish of Inniskeen, the life of fairs and football matches, of mass going and dance going, yet all the time as he stitched himself into the outer patterns of his place, there was a sensitivity and a yearning that distinguished him. For this poet, whom we recognise as being the voice of a communal life, had a fiercely individual sense of himself." But Kavanagh himself, years before, said, "A poet is never one of the people. He is detached, remote, and the life of small-time dances and talk about football would not be for him." It's clear then that much of Kavanagh's poetry is concerned with poetry itself, the power of it, the process of it, and the role of the poet themselves. Other themes that are explored in Kavanagh's work include rural life, the Irish countryside, and nature more generally. Kavanagh often gives us an unflinching portrait of the struggles and realities of rural Ireland. In describing the countryside, the natural world, we see his love for it. He has spoken often about his attachment to and love for Inniskeen and the County Monaghan landscape, and we see him often comparing aspects of it to more famous places, such as Shankaduff and the Alps, in order to metaphorically suggest that Shankaduff is just as important and impressive to him as the Alps are. And despite his love for the countryside, he's also deeply critical of the life of the farmer in rural Ireland. The Great Hunger explores the constraints that are placed upon people living in rural Ireland by society, the church, and often each other. Nature is also used to indicate the passage of time, the movement of the seasons, and as a way into memory, as seen in A Christmas Childhood. Finally, there is the collective themes of identity, isolation, and loneliness. As we've seen, Kavanagh lived his life as and felt like the outsider. A poet farmer, misunderstood and unable to engage with his local community on an authentic level, he was stereotyped and alienated in the more literary cities of London and particularly Dublin. The loneliness that stems from this experience is clear in a poem like Advent, where a life is lived disconnected from simple everyday experiences. Similarly, there's the importance of personal history in the creation of identity. Now let's look at some aspects of Kavanagh's style. Patrick Kavanagh also has a distinctive poetic style that we can identify. One of Kavanagh's signature techniques is his simplicity, particularly in his vocabulary. Again, Heaney, when writing about Kavanagh, said, "From his earliest success in the sonnet Inniskeen Road, July Evening, with its luminous, laddish notice of every blooming thing, right down to the spontaneous opulence of the canal bank sonnets, The poems are where he finds and keeps a marvellous balance between his resolute down-to-earthness and his equally undeniable impulse to transcendence. Cavan is deliberately aiming for simplicity, and through this simplicity, moments of illumination arise. Cavan himself said that the best thing about modern poets of his time was their utter simplicity. Cavan doesn't write dense, inaccessible poetry. He aims for simplicity to highlight his own creative genius. Another element of style frequently seen in Kavanagh's work is his use of vivid imagery. He paints pictures for the readers through his descriptions, usually of place or things within certain places. We see it again and again throughout his poetry, where a small detail, the hills hoarding the bright shillings in Shankadoff, or the wet sack flapping about the knees of time in The Great Hunger, are vividly described, bringing Kavanagh's ideas and description to life.
If you're serious about your exams, StudyClicks Premium is the best way to study. You'll get access to every exam question by topic, marking schemes and solutions, plus exclusive mock exam questions and papers. No more scrambling for the right questions, just structured exam-ready prep. And for podcast listeners, here's €10 off with this code PODCAST10 at checkout. Go to studyclicks.ie and get your upgrade today.
Aside from all the other devices, the similes, the metaphors, the alliteration, the assonance that Kavanagh uses, one of the things that really marks his poetry as unique is the tone. He often uses colloquial language, everyday words, the sort of language used in the places he's writing about, to add to that sense of authenticity. There are fragments of speech, idioms and sayings that bring us into the world of the poem, but there's also humour and satire. He frequently critiques cultural and societal norms using a playful yet cutting tone. Sometimes, too, tone is deployed to create a reflective or even philosophical mood within his work, helping him to explore deeper questions about existence, identity, the human condition, loss of innocence, and the desire for spiritual renewal. So, now that we have some idea of what Kavanagh explores in his poetry and what techniques he uses, let's take a look at the poems that are on the Leaving Cert course. So the first poem that we're going to look at is Inniskeen Road, July Evening. This is the earliest of all the Kavanagh poems on the Leaving Cert syllabus, appearing in 1936. It was written when Kavanagh lived as a farmer poet, as we described earlier. While he loved living in Inniskeen, he was worried at this stage that he would remain there for his whole life, and the sense of disconnection between him and the community around him emerges in this work. The poem describes a summer evening in Kavanagh's native village. In form, it is a sonnet. The first 8 lines, or the octet, shows us 2 images of Inniskeen Road. The first is the road filled with people on their way to the dance in Billy Brennan's barn. The second is the empty road after everyone has gone in. We see Kavanagh's use of colloquial language in the opening few lines when he talks of Billy Brennan's barn, and also his skill at manufacturing a sense of bustle and busyness through his use of alliteration. And the poem seems to move quickly, mirroring the flow of people moving towards the dance. The reference to the half-talk code of mysteries and the wink and elbow language of delight is effective in positioning the speaker outside of this code. He's observing it, but he's not part of it. The second image comes in lines 4-8. It is the same scene, but it is suddenly still and quiet. The pace of the lines slow down, and we have the long O sounds in road, throne, and stone. They help to create a mournful mood, and the use of negatives, no and not, in these lines emphasize the absence on the road and add to the sense of stillness and quiet. The secrecies of stone, like the coded half-talk in the opening lines, add to the idea that the speaker is not admitted to these things. He's on the outside looking in, just like literally he is on outside Billy Brennan's barn and everybody else is inside. Line 9, the first line of the sestet, or the last 6 lines, sees the speaker turning the focus on himself and using I. And we see that he does not enjoy the isolation of his situation and the fact that he has chosen this life, the poet's life, for himself doesn't make this isolation and loneliness any easier to bear. The idea that he has chosen this path for himself is reinforced by the reference to Alexander Selkirk in these lines. Selkirk was a voluntary castaway. So Kavanagh clearly believes that poets have an exalted status in society, but it's a position that comes at a cost. There's ambiguity in the last lines of the poem, where the speaker refers to himself as king of every blooming thing. Blooming here could be viewed positively, as referring to nature and the flowering and flourishing of plants, and maybe even of the creative inner spirit. But it could also be a colloquial way of referring to the area around him, conveying a bitterness, maybe even an enviousness of the other people that were present in lines 1-4. It's up to the reader to decide which way they think Kavanagh is leaning. In this poem, Kavanagh dramatises his position in the local community and uses the sonnet form to counteract the colloquial language that captures the essence of the place. the tensions between these two ideas, the formality of the poetic form and the ordinariness of a dance at Billy Brennan's barn, is also mirrored in the tension between Kavanagh's desires to connect and be part of the community and the necessity, in his mind at least, for the poet to be detached and aloof. Okay, the next poem we'll look at is Shanco Duff. This poem is another of the early ones, written a couple of years before Kavanagh left Monaghan for London. This is actually one of Kavanagh's favourite poems, and he refers in the poem to an area of land half a mile from the Kavanagh home that the family bought in 1926. The land was poor, it was hilly and bad soil, but Kavanagh loved it. In Shanco Duff, Kavanagh opens with a vivid depiction of the landscape, emphasising the bleak and rugged nature of the hills. The imagery of black hills that have never seen the sun rising conveys a sense of perpetual darkness and hardship. This sets the tone for the poem, highlighting the challenges faced by those living in such an environment. The poet's deep emotional connection to the land is evident throughout the poem. Despite the bleakness, there is a sense of pride and attachment in Kavanagh's descriptions. He refers to the hills as my hills, indicating a personal and possessive relationship. This pride is further underscored by the defiance in his tone as he acknowledges the hardships but remains steadfast in his attachment to Shanco Duff. Kavanagh's use of personification brings the landscape to life, making it an active participant in the poem. The hills are depicted as having their own moods and characteristics, such as being under their hoods of fog on a dull day. This personification emphasises the poet's view of the landscape as more than just a physical space. It is a living entity with which he interacts on a deeply personal level. The reflective tone of the poem invites readers to consider their own connections to place and heritage. Kavanagh's introspective musings on the impact of Shanco Duff on his life and identity resonate with universal themes of belonging and rootedness. The poem encourages readers to reflect on how their own environments shape their experiences and sense of self. The critic Antoinette Quinn suggests that the ending of the poem, particularly the ambivalence introduced by the lines, "A poet, then by heavens he must be poor. I hear, and is my heart not badly shaken?" These lines emphasise his insecurities and fear of judgment by those unfamiliar with the place. She says, "Shanco Duff is a reflexive poem in which Kavanagh dramatises his ambivalence towards localising his verse of exposing what is near and dear to the detached appraisal of outsiders." Okay, the third poem that we're going to look at is the extract from section one of The Great Hunger. The Great Hunger was first published in 1942 and attracted a great deal of controversy and admiration. Controversy in the themes it dealt with and the criticisms it levelled and admiration for its scope, scale and the technical scale on show. The section of The Great Hunger that's on the Leaving Cert course is part of a much longer poem. So the full work is 14 sections, 756 lines, providing a powerful and poignant critique of rural Irish life, focusing on the character Patrick Maguire, whose life is marked by unfulfilled desires, isolation and the oppressive monotony of farming. The poem explores themes of spiritual and emotional desolation, highlighting the sacrifices and constraints imposed by tradition and societal expectations. The Great Hunger was the name Irish peasants gave to the Irish famine of the 1840s. Aside from mass emigration and starvation, the famine also had a profound effect on marriage in Ireland. After the famine, the average age of marriage increased dramatically as economic instability meant that people had to wait much longer before they had the financial means to start a family. Many young men waited until their mothers died before marrying, meaning that some stayed single their entire lives. And also, there was a huge decline in population, so there weren't as many available partners for people to marry, even if they wanted to. It is precisely this phenomenon of lonely, isolated, unmarried bachelor Patrick Maguire who Kavanagh introduces us to in The Great Hunger. The poem begins with a stark portrayal of Patrick Maguire's life, rooted deeply in the monotonous and grueling routines of farming. The opening lines immediately establish the sombre tone and the sense of entrapment that pervades the poem. The imagery of clay serves as a powerful metaphor for both the land and the people who work it. The repetition of clay underscores the inescapable connection between the farmer and the earth, suggesting a life that is as unchanging and inert as the soil itself. Throughout this section, Kavanagh emphasises the theme of isolation. Maguire's existence is depicted as solitary, despite being surrounded by other workers. His life is dominated by routine and physical labour, leaving little room for personal fulfilment or meaningful connections. The repetition of Maguire and his men highlights the monotonous cycle of work, and the phrase, "No one will speak for the hand that forged this beauty," suggests a lack of recognition and appreciation for the toil and sacrifice involved in farming. Kavanagh delves into Maguire's inner world, revealing his unfulfilled desires and emotional desolation. The protagonist is depicted as a man who has sacrificed personal happiness for the sake of duty and tradition. His unfulfilled sexual and romantic desires are poignantly captured. The imagery here conveys a sense of longing and loss, with the whiskered grassy wind symbolizing the freedom and passion that Maguire has been denied. His suspicion of women indicates a deeper fear of vulnerability and intimacy. The reference to the queen in line 12 can be read to mean the soil. It is too long virgin. It is unable to satisfy the needs of the farmer, the man who has loved her. The relationship then is one that does not produce anything except a sense of futility and despair. The queen could also be, as Antoinette Quinn believes, a reference to the Virgin Mary. In Catholicism, Mary, the Mother of God, is often used as the model of purity and chastity for other women to match up to. This also relates to the Catholic Church's teaching about sex and the fact that it created a stigma around sex, that it was inherently sinful and shameful. This had a profound effect on Irish people in an overbearingly Catholic environment. Kavanagh employs rich natural imagery and symbolism to illustrate Maguire's plight. The rural landscape is depicted as both beautiful and oppressive, reflecting the dual nature of Maguire's existence. The darkness in the noon and marsh in the evening symbolise the pervasive sense of despair and stagnation that characterises his life. These lines evoke a sense of entrapment, with natural elements such as bushes, hedges and furrows acting as metaphors for the societal and personal constraints that bind Maguire to his land. One of the most interesting aspects of the poem is the attitude of the narrator to Maguire himself. Many people have understood The Great Hunger to be reflective of Kavanagh's anguish and pain at the waste and suffering in rural communities across Ireland, communities that he is deeply familiar with and came from himself, as well as a critique of the devastating impact arbitrary societal norms and religious rules can have on the human spirit. But the narrator is not sympathetic to Maguire, or at least doesn't seem to be. At times he even sounds patronising towards him. This irony, at the heart of the poem, is one that readers have to grapple with and try to understand for themselves. The power of the great hunger cannot be understated. The Irish poet John Montagu said in an article after Kavanagh's death that, "With the great hunger, the reality of rural life appeared for the first time in Anglo-Irish poetry. The ripples from that extraordinary work are still spreading, for, as well as being a masterwork, it changed the whole course of Irish poetry. Henceforth, whatever their background, education, and obsession, poets would have to measure themselves against Kavanagh's breathtaking honesty of vision." The next poem we're going to look at is Advent. So this poem appeared in the same collection as The Great Hunger in 1947, but it shows a movement, or the beginnings of a movement, away from the harsh criticisms of Irish society and life and towards more of a broad acceptance of the world as it is, maybe even admitting some joy and happiness too. The poem is written as two sonnets, perhaps appropriate for a poem entitled Advent. Advent is the 4 weeks leading up to the 25th of December, Christmas Day. It is a time characterised by restraint and order. Kavanagh mentions the dry bread and sugarless tea. The sonnet form obviously is strictly ordered, and Kavanagh was attracted to the discipline of it. We see the sonnet form also in Inniskeen Road, July Evening. This poem, Advent, opens with the speaker, in this case Kavanagh himself, addressing his love, most likely Kavanagh's artistic muse or soul. There is a possibility it could be read as Adam addressing Eve. The loss of innocence, or the loss of the Garden of Eden, is a theme explored in the poem. The overarching theme of the poem is spiritual and poetic renewal. In fact, the poem was initially entitled Renewal, and Kavanagh suggests that deprivation, either of luxuries or of the current way of life, can lead to this renewal. Because of this, some have argued that all Kavanagh is doing is reinforcing Catholic teaching that pleasure is somehow sinful, but others suggest that Kavanagh is saying that depriving oneself of easy luxuries purifies the self, or purifies the soul, and makes one more open to experiencing Jesus Christ. The poem opens with a contemplation on the theme of loss and the yearning to recover a lost innocence. The opening lines set a reflective and somber tone, highlighting the idea that through excessive experience, tested and tasted too much, the wonder and innocence of life have been lost. The Advent-darkened room symbolises a period of reflection and penance, suggesting that through austerity, the dry black bread and the sugarless tea, one might regain a sense of purity and even a sense of wonder. Kavanagh contrasts the corrupted present with a nostalgically remembered past. The theme of regaining innocence is central to the poem, suggesting that through the process of Advent, characterized by waiting and preparation, one can experience spiritual and emotional rejuvenation. These lines evoke a return to simpler, more meaningful experiences. The everyday sounds of rural life, such as the whispered argument of a churning or the music of milking parlours, are imbued with a sense of magic and significance that modern life has lost. Kavanagh's use of imagery and symbolism throughout the poem is vivid and evocative. He employs religious and pastoral imagery to underscore the themes of purity, renewal, and the cyclical nature of life. Here, clay-minted wages symbolize the ephemeral rewards of earthly pleasures and knowledge, which are discarded in favor of a more profound spiritual awakening. The image of Christ comes with a January flower, symbolizes new beginnings and the potential for spiritual rebirth following a period of penance and reflection. Kavanagh contrasts the innocence of childhood with the disillusionment of adulthood. The loss of childlike wonder is lamented, and the poem expresses a desire to reclaim that sense of purity and joy. The chink too wide suggests that excessive exposure to the world's complexities has diminished the capacity for wonder. The austerity of dry black bread and the sugarless tea represent a return to simplicity through which the luxury of a child's soul can be regained.
Leaving Cert Biology is content heavy, but StudyClick's Biology Boost breaks it down. With 300 plus bite-sized videos, examiner-approved tips, and detailed experiment breakdowns, you'll cover every topic, from cell biology to ecology, without feeling overwhelmed. Get the study structure you need at a fraction of the cost of grinds, and because you're listening, here's €10 off with the code PODCAST10. Head over to studyclicks.ie and take control of your biology study today.
So our next poem is A Christmas Childhood, and there are strong thematic links between Advent and A Christmas Childhood. This nostalgic poem recalls the magic and innocence of Kavanagh's own childhood Christmases, celebrating the wonder and the simplicity of youth and almost recapturing that wonder that he talks about in Advent. The difference between the Christmases of his youth and those of his later years living in Dublin was stark. He said of his later years, "On many Christmas days, I sat in my frowsy flat with nothing to eat and uninvited by anyone." There is some irony here in that Kavanagh's romantic, nostalgic recollections of childhood focus on the magic and wonder of the child, where the ordinary became extraordinary. But it overlooks the spiritual, sexual and psychological poverty as described in The Great Hunger. It's a creative recreation of the past. The poem opens with a recreation of childhood wonder for the world around them. This idea of wonder and magic continues when Kavanagh describes the children leaning their heads against the fence post to hear the hum of the wire reverberating through the wood. Every sound and sight seems to add to the young child's delight. Kavanagh imagines that a gap between the hayricks is a hole in heaven's gable. An apple tree is compared to the tree in the Garden of Eden. This adult world tempted Kavanagh and took away his innocence. There's a sense of regret, maybe even resentment. The difference between part one and part two is the absence of the adult commentator in part two. The second part of the poem is filled with the child's memories. The adult voice, with its regret and resentment, vanishes as the poet loses himself in the excitement of the childhood Christmas. The rhyme scheme also recedes, and we are left with unmediated, unadulterated childhood experience. Ultimately, what Kavanagh seems to be saying in this poem is that as we age, we lose our childlike wonder, but this view or way of seeing can be recaptured, even in adulthood, if we're able to tune into the magic and the music of the ordinary world. Our next poem is one of Kavanagh's most famous poems. So, On Raglan Road was written to be set to music and sung most famously by Luke Kelly. Published in 1946, it is a poem about failure in love, something Kavanagh personally experienced many times throughout his life. It is written as a ballad and describes the failure of the love affair, leading the speaker to warn the reader not to love too much, that it can backfire and cause pain and suffering. If we follow the language closely, we see that it is not the most flattering portrayal of Kavanagh as a man or potential romantic partner. As discussed earlier, Kavanagh is a poet of place. In this case, the place is Raglan Road in Dublin. He uses other Dublin street and place names in an effort to communicate to readers the ordinary, everyday nature of these events happening around them in the city. The speaker talks about seeing and falling in love with a dark-haired woman who, in reality, was 22-year-old medical student Hilda Moriarty, a woman who Kavanagh, by then aged 40, became infatuated with. When she rejected him, he was bitterly disappointed. The poem transitions from autumn, a time of endings and decay, through November to some future undefined moment when the former lovers pass as old ghosts. The month of May is mentioned also, giving us a sense of time passing as well as moving through a succession of feelings such as sorrow, regret, pride, and perhaps even arrogance. It's difficult to feel much sympathy for Kavanagh in this poem, despite the rejection, because we get the sense that he's not taking much responsibility for the failure of the relationship, if that's what it was. He signals bitterness by saying he threw away happiness in gambling on love. He seems to think that she should have been more grateful for the gifts of the mind that he gave her, in essence, his poetry, and because he showed her insights into the poetic process, the secret sign. The end of the poem further highlights this attitude from the speaker, maybe even a certain arrogance or a suggestion again of the position of the poet in society. He bitterly regrets falling for this woman who, he realises now, was not the heavenly being he thought she was, and instead was earthly, mortal, and made of clay. By falling for this woman, he himself has had his wings clipped, so to speak. When the angel woos the clay, he'd lose his wings at the dawn of day. This woman, this dark-haired temptress, is dragging him down from his lofty position of an intellectual, a poet, and he's better off without her, at least in terms of his poetic vision. There is, of course, sadness and regret there too, but as we've seen, it's not that easy to feel sympathy for the speaker in this poem. The next poem we're going to look at is Epic. So Seamus Heaney said of this poem, his sonnet Epic is his affirmation of the profound importance of the parochial. So this poem was written at a time when Kavanagh was shifting from the savage satirical attacks on church, state and rural stereotypes to a calmer, more reflective handling of memory and place. In this poem, set in 1938 in the build-up to the outbreak of World War II, at a time when the ideas of boundaries and borders in Europe was very important, we see a local border row and how Kavanagh magnifies its importance and makes it universal. The opening lines attest to the fact that this border dispute is faintly ridiculous. It's a half rood, an eighth of an acre of rocky land, but the following lines underscore the serious aspect of these disputes. Kavanagh's opening declaration that he has lived in important places, times when great events were decided, could well be seen as humorous. It's clear that this dispute, played out in a field in Monaghan, is not a great event, but maybe it's as great as anything else. Perhaps it is just as Heaney has said, that it shows the profound importance of the parochial, that greatness is a quality bestowed by the person who shines their light on an event. In that sense, the boundary dispute in Epic is just as important as larger border disputes in Europe and further afield. Who's to judge otherwise? We've seen Kavanagh utilise the sonnet form previously in a number of poems, and he does so again here with great skill. The octet, the opening eight lines, details the local dispute, while the sestet, the following six lines, is more reflective, looking at why the subject matter was chosen with regards to wider conflicts in Europe. The combination of the classic sonnet form with local details, place names, colloquial language, is effective in raising the importance of the local to that of anywhere that has had sonnets written about it. And as in On Raglan Road, there is also a sense of the poet's sense of his own greatness, although it's much less pronounced here and it could very well be playful. The reference at the end to Homer and the Iliad and the line, "Gods make their own importance," could be seen as the speaker putting himself on the same level as Homer, one of the greatest epic poets of all time. So high praise from himself indeed. The next poem is The Hospital, and this is the first of the last three poems that we're going to look at, and they stem from the spring of 1956 during Kavanagh's recovery from surgery for lung cancer. So this was a time of spiritual rebirth for Kavanagh, and there's a distinctly different tone to these poems than some of the others. There's much less bitterness, and these poems again focus on place, perhaps reflecting the time he has spent in Dublin. Now he compares the Grand Canal, his new Eden, with the Monaghan countryside, his first Eden. This poem again uses the sonnet form to explore love of place. The first eight lines, the octet, described a hospital ward. It's a surprising thing to declare your love for, but as we know with Kavanagh, this isn't so much about the hospital ward itself, it's more the idea of place, and more so the idea of finding something extraordinary in the ordinary. So Kavanagh does not hide how plain the objects he sees in the octet are. But nothing, regardless of how plain it appears, is debarred from love. Here, Kavanagh is exploring further his long-standing concern with the idea that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, or in this case, the poet who sets his gaze on the object. You can, it seems, Kavanagh is saying, love anything. It's to be found in the ordinary, almost as if it's a choice, a deliberate choice. The sestet that follows, it deals with the idea that this love transforms the object in turn. love should be honest and true. And if it is, Kavanagh seems to be saying that it can preserve things. Recording them can make them last forever. It can counteract the passage of time. So the gate that's been bent after a truck drove into it, properly observed, properly recorded, can stand as a monument to love. Despite Kavanagh's appeal to simplicity and the recording of love's mystery without claptrap, there's still a lot of sophisticated poetic technique to admire in this poem. The sonnet structure itself, of course, with its rhyme scheme and meter, as well as the gradual movement from the simple descriptions in the octet to the final, deeper reflection using more sophisticated language in that last line. So the next poem we're going to look at is Canal Bank Walk. So this poem is the first of two of Kavanagh's canal sonnets on the Leaving Cert course. And they signify, as we've already mentioned, that idea of a new Eden, a rebirth for Kavanagh after his health problems. It's almost as if the Grand Canal has helped him come to terms with his new life away from Monaghan. It just took him a few years to adjust. This sonnet opens with a beautiful, sensuous description of the power of the water to help him reconnect to nature, be redeemed and, as a result, be reborn or perhaps even rebaptized. There's a connection here between the original love of Shanca Duff, his original Eden, and the canal in Dublin. He once recognized the importance of place, of the land, of nature, and how it fed him spiritually, sustained him. He's moved away from that now. He spent years drifting, but here, since his health problems and his recuperation, he's rediscovered the power of nature, of observing simple things, the banal, to restore him. The second quatrain, or set of four lines, describes the speaker sitting still and watching a couple kissing, a bird gathering sticks, things that are representative of love in a way, of the natural way of the world. In this frame of mind, it is easy for him to be reborn, to grow with nature. There's also the idea of the word, a reference to the book of Genesis that describes God bringing the world into being by naming things. The poet here names, and through naming the things that are seen, it becomes an act of creation. There is a sense of harmony. Everything is performing the will of God and is in its right place, even the speaker. Similar to the hospital, the sestet of the sonnet marks a departure in terms of language. He moves from the colloquial, simple language in the first eight lines to something altogether more reverential and elevated in the sestet. It starts with the word O, almost like a prayer, and he goes on to express the hope that this new enchantment he feels with nature, with life, will go on. He recognises that he is in need of this current state of mind, but he hopes that it will last, a recognition perhaps of the brevity or temporality of this state of happiness. At the heart of this poem, and some of Kavanagh's other sonnets, is an appeal to the sudden instinctual recognition of nature, the power of the natural world, the spiritual application of what he sees as God's will. But of course, these are carefully crafted pieces of work. So they're not altogether instinctual. They're not altogether sudden. Notice the octet and the sestet, the strict adherence to rhyme scheme, the gradual shift in tone and language in each of the ones we've looked at. So while the impulse or the feeling may be sudden or natural, the result, the poem, is a carefully crafted monument to that impulse. Kavanagh himself said that a poet is born, not made, is well known. But this does not mean that he was a poet the day he was physically born. For many a good-looking year, I wrought hard at versing. But I would say that, as a poet, I was born in or about 1955, the place of my birth being the banks of the Grand Canal. 30 years earlier, Shanca Duff's watery hills could have done the trick, but I was too thick to take the hint. Curious this, how I had started off with the right simplicity, indifferent to crude reason, and then ploughed my way through complexities and anger, hatred and ill will toward the faults of man, and came back to where I started. The last poem that we're going to look at is Lines Written on a Seat on the Grand Canal, Dublin. So this is our final poem, and it suitably discusses Kavanagh's wish to be memorialised or commemorated by the banks of the Grand Canal in Dublin. Today, there's a statue and a bench on the Grand Canal commemorating the poet just as he wishes in this poem. So in this poem, we see many of the aspects of Kavanagh's work that we've discussed previously. He focuses on place, the Grand Canal, and through naming and describing, he expresses his love for it. Also, through exaggeration. We saw in Shanca Duff the comparison between a small hill in Monaghan and the Matterhorn in the Alps. Here, the water is compared surreptitiously to Niagara Falls through the lovely word Niagarously. He encourages the reader to look and, by extension, see, furthering his concept of the poetic eye, bringing attention to ordinary things. Here, a barge coming from a thigh, in order to magnify them and truly experience them. There are many symbols in the poem. We see the barge, the light, the swan, and also the idea of Mount Parnassus, that those who sit by the canal will feel inspired, as if they are at the home of the muses of poetry, music, and learning. We have seen Kavanagh's craft at work throughout the poems we've examined, but obviously, there is also Kavanagh himself at the heart of this poem. We've seen Calvin's sense of himself appear at times through his work. The idea that he was separate, necessarily so, from his community in Inniskeen because he was a poet. The idea that he is somehow in the same company as Homer appears in Epic. The poems from his early years in Dublin are replete with his savage critiques of church and state, and we could be forgiven for thinking him presumptuous to expect or ask to be commemorated, but even though that's what he's doing here, it doesn't come across as arrogant. He is self-effacing, and the sense of the poet's I, Kavanagh's own person, is kept in the background in favour of the poet's I, E-Y-E, forefronting the idea that it is poetic vision that should be commemorated or memorialised more so than the poet himself.
And that concludes Peter Tobin's analysis on the poetry of Patrick Kavanagh. We hope this has helped you gain a deeper understanding of Kavanagh's poems and equipped you with the knowledge to write strong essays for your English exam. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend, and we'd really encourage you to check out Peter Tobin's YouTube channel, which we have linked in the show notes. As he mentioned at the start of this podcast, it's packed with free resources on all aspects of the Leaving Cert English course, and it's well worth checking out. Thanks for listening, and be sure to follow StudyClicks on social media for the latest updates on new content that we're making that will make your exams easier. Bye!